Bicentennial 5.
Welcome to Bicentennial 5. This is the fifth of 10 programs featuring speakers from around the Midwest highlighting the impact of different ethnic groups on the American civilization. This program with Dr. Michael Carney deals with the events in northeastern Minnesota in the early 1900s when the Finnish immigrants challenged the corporate power structure.
My presentation concerns the growth of Finnish unionism and socialism on the Mesabi and Vermilion Iron Ranges, the Great Strike of 1907, and its consequences for the whole Finnish immigrant group in the area. This presentation focuses on the period 1906-1909, when Finnish labor activism, inspired largely by disillusionment with America, was just getting underway, and when Finnish-American unionists first tried to assert their rights to management. It is essentially a tale of harsh establishment reaction and repression to the attempt of a foreign-born group to advocate values contrary to those of the dominant Anglo-Saxon tradition. The Finns tried and failed to change Minnesota's industrial and political systems. Their penalty for failing will be recounted in the course of this lecture. During the early evening of July 31st, 1906, a small parade wound its way through the downtown streets of Hibbing, Minnesota, led by a man carrying a red flag. All but one of the marchers were Finnish immigrants who had gathered from as far away as Seattle and Philadelphia as delegates to a conference called to found a National Federation of Finnish Immigrant Socialist Clubs. The conference was to begin the next morning and was scheduled to be in session until August 6th. The non-Finn in the parade was Teofila Petriella, an organizer for the Western Federation of Miners who had worked with good success among Finnish miners in the copper district of northern Michigan. He was in Hibbing making preparations for a Western Federation organizing drive set for the winter and spring of 1906 and 1907, and he was determined to exploit rising Finnish sentiment for socialism to the benefit of his union. The marchers stopped in the center of town and set up a barrel as a speaker's platform. As a sizable group of onlookers gathered, the marchers sang several verses of the Workers' March. After the song, Comrade Alex Holonen, socialist organizer and representative of the American Socialist Party, mounted the makeshift platform and gave a brief but rousing speech on socialism in Finnish. He was followed by Petriella, who spoke in Italian. Then, in English, Holonen explained the significance of the parade and speeches. Their purpose, he said, quote, was to give the residents of Hibbing a slight foretaste of the socialists' presence, end of quote. Participants in the parade and rally later reported that, quote, the police were good-natured despite the fact that the barrel had been set up on the corner by City Hall. The police apparently were unaware that night of the real significance of the socialists' presence. In retrospect, their parade and week-long conference must be seen as a declaration of war by a large segment of the Finnish-American workforce in the area against the corporate structure of northeastern Minnesota. It was a war the Finnish socialists would eventually lose and that in the process would bring down the full wrath of Minnesota's established powers upon themselves, as well as taint the reputation of all Finnish immigrants in the Mesabi district for a generation to come. The first battle in the war came the next summer, in 1907. The great Mesabi strike of that year pitted the Finnish Socialists and the Western Federation of Miners against United States Steel Corporation and a welter of smaller companies. But the companies found allies in American businessmen, the state government, the state press, the federal government, and even in the conservative elements of the local Finnish community. The strike on the Mesabi in 1907, the first attack by organized labor against the mining companies, was a total defeat for the Union and the Finnish socialists who participated. But the Finns never admitted defeat. In fact, they waged intermittent war against Minnesota's corporations for the next 30 years through such organizations as the Industrial Workers of the World, the Communist Party, and the Consumers Cooperative Movement. After the strike of 1907, however, they approached their foe more soberly, with only limited optimism, but with quiet resolve. for the events between 1906 and 1909 taught them just how powerful entrenched capitalism was, especially when it was supported by nativistic elements within American society. On August 1st, 1906, the morning after the Hibbing parade and street rally, the socialist delegates began their conference, debating such wide-ranging topics as unionism, consumers' cooperatives, the role of women in the class struggle, the relationship of religion to socialism, and even the significance of the recent mutiny in the garrison at Fort Viaputi in Helsinki Harbor. When the conference was over, few of the issues debated had been completely resolved, but an organization had been born, called Suomalainen Sosialistijärjestö, or the Finnish Socialist Federation. It would soon become the first and largest foreign language wing of the American Socialist Party. And within 6 years, it would boast about 15,000 members in over 270 locals, most of them in the Western Great Lakes region. But how does one account for such a strange phenomenon? Immigrant workers as radicals? Popular American conception has it that European immigrants docilely accepted the lowest rungs of the American economic ladder as their rite of passage into the American middle class. Working at menial jobs upon arrival in America was the price one had to pay for something better eventually, realization of the American dream. Why then radicalism among the Finns? The reasons, of course, are many and complicated. They have to do with forces at work both in Finland and the United States and how those forces helped to fashion the particular cultural, social, religious, and political alignments in Finnish-American society. Between the 1860s and 1920s, over 300,000 Finns left Finland for the United States. At first, they eagerly took jobs in quarries and canneries, on the docks, and in mines and lumber camps, hoping to become prosperous and return to Finland. Their beliefs about America, like those of so many other immigrants, were expressed in a song they sang as they boarded steamships in Finland to leave for America. "I'm going to America, everybody's on his way. The American shores are sanded with gold, they say. I'll embark from Hangoniemi and on a small boat I'll go, because Finland can't support the children of her poor." Thus, with optimism, they left their homeland bound for better things. But if expectations rose even higher when the shores of America came into view from the steamer's decks, they were soon dispelled when the immigrants reached their destinations inland. One woman, Irene Paul, probably spoke for many when she said, and I quote her, "I was small when I came along with thousands to the land of the free at the turn of the century. My mother held me up to see the Statue of Liberty in New York Harbor, and we rode the train with others going to the North Country, and I looked out the window and saw what I would never forget, the red Mesabi. Everything was red. The roads, the water in the ditch, the miners' clothes, the big open pit, the sidewalks, the skin of the people. The red ore seemed to penetrate, to drive into everything. I came to know it stood for U.S. Steel, which claimed our lives, our thoughts, and our allegiance. Father worked in the red mine. My mother would cry when she tried to wash off the red dirt from my father's clothes and body. The neighbors around us spoke a strange language. My mother would wash the clothes and cry for Finland." End of quote. Or, as a Finnish woman of Duluth told a WPA Writers Project interviewer in 1938, "I tell you, I was really disappointed the first day I came to Tri Mountain, Michigan. I was at my father's place, and I looked out the back window at all the ash cans and garbage thrown around the back alley. I tell you, I was so disappointed, I would have gone back to Finland that very day if they had let me." So, instead of a worldly paradise, the Finns found squalid mining locations in Michigan, Minnesota, and Montana with strange, unpronounceable names like Negaunee, Ishpeming, Biwabik, Keewatin, Sand Coulee, and Butte. Those who went to the woods even found more squalid, tarred paper, barrack-like structures designated simply as Camp No. 3 of Virginia Rainy Lake Company or Camp No. 5 of Black Lady Lumber Company. Only a relatively few went directly to the farms they so often dreamed of, and then only to find a life filled with grubbing stumps and trying to farm stony, unproductive soil. The quality of life in the mining towns in northern Michigan and Minnesota, as suggested by the quotations above, was anything but ideal. One writer has compared the conglomeration of tarred paper shacks, log huts, and cheap company barracks and cottages which graced the pit sides, to eastern slums and immigrant ghettos, overcrowded, unventilated, and unsanitary. Working conditions were equally as bad. Thousands of immigrants from many different lands labored under extremely dangerous conditions for very low pay and extremely limited chances for advancement. In northern Minnesota, for example, officials of the Oliver Iron Mining Company, a subsidiary of U.S. Steel, frankly admitted that they discriminated against foreigners when deciding upon employee advancement. One U.S. Steel official told an interviewer that, quote, "We move men along faster than in other companies, but we don't push any but the American-born onto the steam shovels or other machines," unquote. Thus, most immigrants from southern and eastern Europe and Finland were condemned to drudge as manual laborers all their working lives, while advancement went to the few native-born American laborers in the mines and to Cornishmen who were brought to the copper and iron ranges for their mining experience and who, of course, spoke English. One young Finnish miner recalled his first days on the job as follows. "My first days were a foretaste of hell. After making several trips from the diggings to the shaft pushing a heavy tram car, I was wretchedly tired. My thirst was unquenchable. Sweat flowed in rivulets from my pores. My legs threatened to give way and my body became limp. My partner saw that I was exhausted, but instead of slowing his pace, he speeded it. Apparently, he wanted to show me what America was really like. When lunchtime came, my food did not go down. My eyes saw dizzily. My ears rang. My heart pounded violently. After the shift was over, my partner showed me his gnarled, rust-eaten hands. When your paws are like these, he said, you'll be able to stand the grind." Not only was the physical strain on an individual on the Mesabi as rending as the description above attests, but the immigrant miner had other serious problems to contend with. Danger was one. During 1905 and 1906, the death rate on the Mesabi was 7.5 workers per 1,000 employed. Between 1905 and 1909, 277 workers were killed in St. Louis County alone. Added to the problem of danger were irritating problems of petty graft by bosses and ethnic contention in the pits, cultivated, it seems, as official policy by management. Previous attempts to remedy some of these conditions through spontaneous strikes and work stoppages had resulted in the gunshot killings by mine guards of five Finnish miners between 1888 and 1905. When one considers all the factors at work in influencing Finnish workers toward socialism and radical labor, the unfulfilled expectations in America, the deplorable working conditions, the youthful anti-clericalism of the workers, the presence of skilled and dedicated socialist agitators, it is logical that the organizers of the Finnish Socialist Federation chose Hibbing, Minnesota, as the location of the founding convention. All these conditions were present in northeastern Minnesota in 1906, perhaps more so than in any other place where Finns lived and worked. If the police had missed the significance of the Hibbing parade and street rally of July 31st, they were given a second chance to learn on August 5th. On that day, several hundred socialists and their sympathizers, led by the Hibbing and Chisholm Socialist Club's bands, playing the Marseillaise and the Workers' March, paraded out of town to the public picnic grounds. There they heard the well-known agitators Kaapo Muros, Alex Halonen, Martin Hendrickson, and Vilho Bohman give long speeches blistering capitalists and clerics. And the cheering was vigorous, but this time the police were listening more carefully, and to make sure they understood what was being said, they had interpreters with them. Also, the picnickers noted with amusement that the bushes of the park seemed to be full of Finnish conservatives who were clucking with alarm at the goings-on. Thus, the Finnish socialists had generated attention in northern Minnesota. After the founding convention concluded its business on Monday, August 6th, the delegates returned home to implement their newly framed resolutions, one of which was to support strong class struggle unions, such as the Western Federation of Miners and the Industrial Workers of the World. The ensuing fall and winter were relatively uneventful. The Finnish radicals contented themselves with an intra-group power struggle. During this period, they won control of a Finnish seminary through a stock-buying battle and converted it into a workers' institute. The institute, which was located in Duluth, was soon renamed Dwevayan Opisto, or Workpeople's College, and became the pride of the socialists for its courses in Marxist theory, labor agitation, and economic history. When the Mesabi pits opened in the spring, however, talk of unionism was in the air. By early summer, the Western Federation had enrolled about 2,500 miners into its union. When Vincent St. John, C.E. Mahoney, and James Kirwan, national leaders of the union, came to assist Petriella, the Finnish socialists eagerly joined in the union organizing drive and in drafting demands to be made on the Oliver Iron Mining Division of United States Steel, largest employer on the Mesabi. The union's plan was to organize at least 50% of the workers on the range before demands were to be made to the companies. But before this organization could be accomplished, the union was undercut by a spontaneous strike of non-Western Federation union ore handlers on the iron ore docks of Duluth and Superior on July 16, 1907. Because the ore handlers' strike threatened to divert attention from the range area, the Western Federation was forced to make its move before it was ready. On July 19th, the union asked the Oliver Company for an 8-hour day, an end to the system of petty bribes and bonuses, and a daily minimum wage of $2.50 for open-pit workers and $3 for underground workers. The Oliver's response to these demands, a response which set a pattern the companies on the Mesabi were to follow until after World War II, was to refuse to negotiate. Immediately after the demands were made, 300 union members were fired. On July 20th, 1907, the first great Mesabi strike began. By the time it was over 2 months later, it had been marred by violence and had cost the Oliver over $250,000 for special deputies and strike breakers alone. The union, naturally, lost. A company which could simply hire a small army to protect its property and import Montenegrins and Croatians from eastern port cities to break the strike was just too strong to defeat. Over 1,100 Slavic workers were brought to the range in the month of August 1907 alone, but the Finnish socialists in the union tried their best. They threw open their halls to serve as strike headquarters, and they were in the forefront of picketing activity. Their wives and children were active in sympathy-provoking demonstrations, and two young Finns with some previous labor union experience, John Mackey and John Kolu, emerged as acknowledged leaders of the strike. It was not long before vilification and retribution descended on the Finnish socialists from all quarters. Before the strike was even over, range businessmen met and decided to deny the strikers the credit necessary to wait out the companies. The Finns responded by hastily establishing consumers' cooperative stores in several range towns. The companies then applied pressure on Duluth wholesalers to stop supplying the cooperatives. Although not all the wholesalers complied, the cooperators were often hard-pressed to supply their stores. The businessmen also concurred with the Oliver Company's decision to arm special deputies to, quote, keep the peace. The businessmen assumed that the deputies would quickly crush the strike and business would return to normal. The plan failed to halt the strike quickly, and the deputies were responsible for most of the violence which occurred. They were not at all reluctant to swing clubs at picketers and to make hundreds of illegal arrests. Newspapers on the range and elsewhere in the state displayed a virulently nativistic attitude toward both Finnish socialists and the union. The front page of the July 27th issue of Hibbing's Mesaba Ore, for example, noted in reporting a strike demonstration that, quote, fully 90% of those in line were Finlanders, fiery followers of the red flag. The remainder of the motley crowd was made up of Austrians, Italians, and Montenegros, not one American appearing in line, end of quote. The same paper went on in an editorial to call the leaders of the Western Federation of Miners, quote, a band of murderers, cutthroats, leeches, and grafters, whose motto is ruin, rapine, bloodshed, and destruction, end of quote. The best, however, was saved for Petriella, the organizer. He was called, quote, a festering putrid ulcer on the body politic, who has found a following in a large class of Finlanders, who in their own turn have long sought the opportunity to make trouble, end of quote. The same editorial, however, distinguished between two classes of Finlanders. One group, consisting of older men, was made up of good citizens, the editorial said. The other group, though, was, quote, a set of lawless young fellows who will not work, who are infused with the lessons of socialism and anarchy, end of quote. The editorial concluded that the young Finns were not beyond redemption, however. They could, and probably would, themselves become good citizens if only the agitators were driven from among them. 4 days later, on July 31st, 1907, the Eveleth News said that most of the strikers were young men, quote, imbued with a nihilistic spirit, and are nihilists and anarchists instead of socialists, as they claim. The Finns that compose this class are not fit to become citizens, end of quote. The Duluth and Minneapolis papers also took notice of the strikers. On July 18th, 2 days before the strike had begun, the Duluth Evening Herald, in response to Finnish socialist street demonstrations, editorialized as follows. The man who flaunts the red flag and who bawls the opinions for which the red flag stands is grossly abusing the hospitality which brought him to this country. The Minneapolis Journal noted, quote, the largest number of Mesaba workers come from Finland in the frozen north, a land where Russia's oppression has bred a hatred of government and a rampant form of socialism. No more dangerous fusing of raw material could be devised, it seems. It is just as though the big corporation that brought them to the range had assembled the ingredients of dynamite to be mixed and await the percussion cap, end of quote. The closest thing to an ally the strikers had was probably the state government. While not exactly siding with the companies, however, it did little to stop the strike or even carefully to investigate its causes. After an incident in which the Oliver Company's special deputies invaded the Nashwauk, Minnesota Socialist Hall, Governor Johnson declared that such actions were illegal. Nevertheless, he forbade the strikers from interfering with workers who wished to cross the picket lines. The governor also refused to call out the militia because he said he had heard of no violence occurring during the strike. In reality, the opposite was true. Company response to the strike was the infamous blacklist. After the strike, the Oliver Company systematically denied Finn's re-employment, regardless of political affiliation, it seems. Before the strike, about 18% of the company's workforce was Finns. After the strike, only about 8% was. This means that over 1,200 Finnish breadwinners were cut off from the major source of employment in northeastern Minnesota. The Finns who remained on the Oliver Company's employment rolls apparently had not participated in the strike or were able to persuade their foreman that they had not. A year after the strike, when asked by the United States Immigration Commission about the qualities of their immigrant workers, mining company superintendents on the Mesabi and Vermilion Range answered as follows about the Finnish workers in their mines. One superintendent said, all the races employed on the Vermilion Range are good laborers except the Finns. They are a people who are good laborers but trouble breeders. We refuse work to everyone who applies wearing the red button of their socialist organization, and it is my desire to weed out this element and see the movement suppressed. Another superintendent said, the Finns are good workers when they want to work, but they are not to be depended on. A third said, for hard physical work, the Finns are preferred, but they are a surly, troublesome lot, and among the younger men are many who are anarchists. Partly in response to the low estimation in which Americans seem to be holding Finns, especially the companies, and partly in response to the embarrassment caused by the socialists' role in the strike, the conservative elements in the Finnish community added their voice to the condemnation of the strikers. The Reverend Carlo Salovaara, the Suomi Synod minister in Eveleth, wrote to a colleague with great alarm that the strike had, quote, a socialistic and a revolutionary base, and that, unfortunately, our dear fellow countrymen are spearheading the enterprise and will have to reap the consequences, unquote. Thus, 1 year after their founding convention, the young Finnish socialists had found the lessons in the school of Morgan and Rockefeller, as they were fond of calling American capitalism, to be difficult ones indeed. Reviled from literally every quarter, alienated even from a large segment of their own countrymen, their future certainly looked bleak. For many, the only alternative was to move to the land and take homesteads. Other socialists left the range to find new jobs and take up the cause elsewhere, perhaps in places like Butte, Montana, where there was a large Finnish community and where the radical labor movement flourished. Still others, apparently, moved to Duluth to study at Work People's College, for its enrollments increased dramatically in the spring of 1908. Its only requirement for admission was that a student must have been a member of the class struggle. And finally, a good number, at least temporarily, drifted out of the labor movement, chastened by the disastrous results of the strike and thinking of their immediate livelihood. But while unionism subsided, Finnish socialism grew. By 1909, when the next national conference of the Finnish Socialist Federation was held, membership had climbed from about 2,500 in 1906 to 5,100 members in 162 locals, and would eventually grow to 17,000 members. The delegates at the 1909 meeting, however, mindful of the accusations of anarchy and atheism hurled at them during the strike, made public a series of resolutions disavowing anarchism and affirming their belief in parliamentary and not revolutionary socialism. They also stressed that religion was regarded by the Federation as a personal matter. Any allegations of atheism, therefore, were unfounded. The socialists were too late to save the Finnish reputation, however. Anti-Finnish feeling continued as before. The stereotypes about them as Reds, anarchists, Mongols, drunks, jackpine savages, and fierce knife fighters also continued. And, unfairly, the epithets concerning radicalism accrued to all Finns, regardless of individual political persuasion, a fact which made job-seeking difficult in the basic industries which had originally attracted the Finns to northern Minnesota. While it is impossible to document subjective attitudes toward Finns in any accurate way, one survey taken in the early 1920s is instructive. Of the respondents questioned, only 16% said they would allow a Finn to marry a close relative. Only 27% said they would have a Finn as a close friend. And only 36% said they would live next door to one. America was not yet ready to accept changes in the relationship between labor and management, especially changes advocated by foreigners and radicals. The reaction and repression which followed the socialists' first attempt to make such changes, however, only tightened their resolve and served to push them in desperation farther to the left in the American political and labor spectrum. The next time the Finns fought United States Steel in northern Minnesota in 1916, it was as members of the Industrial Workers of the World who advocated total immediate revolution and who freely discussed sabotage and assassination as legitimate strike weapons. But that is another story.
Dr. Michael Carney of the Center for Immigration Studies in St. Paul has been our guest lecturer on Bicentennial 5, The Finns in Minnesota. On Bicentennial 6, we'll study the Norwegian impact with Mr. Gerhard Naseth, Associate Director of the University Library at Madison, Wisconsin. The Bicentennial series is produced by the Humanities Series, Midwestern Center.